Model Rail Radio. I'm Tom Barbalay, and this is being recorded live on TalkShoe, April 17th, 2010. Model Rail Radio is an internet radio recorded podcast dealing with the hobby of model railroading. And if folks who are listening in would like to participate in Model Rail Radio, there are a number of different means. There is a Facebook group. You just put Model Rail Radio into the Facebook search. There is the Model Rail Radio mailing list by going to modelrailradio.com and clicking on the mailing list. And also, as this show is recorded live on TalkShoe, when you go to the Model Rail Radio site, you will see the next show, which I believe is going to be on May 1st, 2010. And that will give some indication of your local time to call in. And if the time isn't convenient and you'd like to arrange for a new time for Model Rail Radio so you and perhaps some of your friends who are interested in model railroading in your specific area can call in. This is an international show. And starting with the fact that this is an international show, I'd like to welcome on once again my co-host, Chris Abbott. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom. How are things?
Very, very busy. I think both of us, Chris and I work in different parts of the world, different professions, but when Chris has a busy week, I tend to have a busy week as well. I think there's some kind of strange karmic energy or something like that. But I've had a very busy week, and I understand that you've been similarly busy.
I have been up to my buttocks and alligators, yes.
Very good, very good. So, unfortunately, for the past couple of weeks, as I mentioned to you briefly, we've had a family emergency on my wife's side of the family. So we've had various relations in town and staying with us. So my two-week model railroading update, well, aside from stuff that's been going through the mailing list, hasn't been particularly great. What have you been able to do in the past 2 weeks in the model railroading hobby?
Well, Tom, not much personally. However, I was able last week to take part in an operating session on a double-deck layout, fairly big one. And just today, I was able to go to a narrow-gauge railway show here in Ontario.
Wow. Well, would you like to give a show report to the listening audience?
Yes, I would. I really would. First off, I guess the thing to start with is last week's operating session. The layout belongs to John and Laura Spring in a town just about an hour north of me here. And I've been trying for, well, about 6 months to get up there for an op session. John models the Toronto, Hamilton, and Buffalo Railway in the mid-50s. And it interchanged primarily with the Canadian Pacific. And he models a section of the railway from the center of the town or the city of Hamilton, which includes a beltline run up to some steel mills. Hamilton is a big steel processing town and has been since well before World War II. It's nice to see a mixture of steam and diesel on the railroad, but typical operating crew there would be between 12 and 15 people for an evening. And it runs on a fast clock, I think at 2-to-1 time. So 6 hours is done in 3 hours. It's possible that 6 hours is done in 2 hours at 3-to-1 time clock, but I was so busy, I really wasn't able to determine the ratio. This time, I got to run the beltline switcher job from one of the yards, from Kinnear Yard up to the steel mill. So I was running ore cars up from the yard and through the helix and into hidden staging. John takes about a year to do a day's worth of operating. That is a full 24-hour schedule takes 4 operating sessions of 6 hours each, and he runs, I think, 4 scheduled op sessions per year to do that, not including the maintenance sessions or staging sessions. And I got to tell you, it's a lot of fun to do op sessions. This is me personally. I mean, I know it's not everyone's taste, but to be able to duplicate something that happened in real life that has some historical significance, especially in your own local area, gives you a new appreciation for what's going on and what went on in your area at a certain time frame. And you're modeling both the economic and mechanical aspects of a particular era. It's almost like a time machine. It was really, as I said, a lot of fun. Bit hard on the knees. The yard is hidden staging underneath underneath one of the stations, but I'll put up with that for in exchange for the enjoyment factor.
This was a 2-to-1 time compression, this particular operating session?
It was either 2-to-1 or it was 3-to-1. We started just after 7 o'clock and finished just before 10. So, I guess it must have been a 3-to-1 session, 6 hours modeled in two. But it seems to give you enough time to do your movements without the feeling of being rushed. Well,
yes.
You know, there's some of them, you're running 5 or 6 to 1 on the clock, and
yes.
That means, you know, 6 minutes goes by in one, or 12 minutes goes by in two, and it really doesn't give you time to shunt the various industries around the stations, and it can feel really frenetic, actually, and John's is not like that. You do get, I did make a couple of mistakes. Again, John uses a different system than the car card and waybill. He uses switch lists and train orders. So you have to talk to your local yard master and get permission to enter the yard and get permission to pick up different cars. And your switch list is going to dictate what tracks you pick things up on and what tracks you're going to deliver them to at the end. And I had made a mistake in reading one of the switch lists and missed picking up some cars. However, I was able to return and finish the movement and still end up within rough time frame of where I was supposed to be, a couple minutes late on the fast clock, which was pretty good, I think.
And for folks listening in, that I mean, I have some kind of, from your description, I have some kind of visual idea of what you were actually doing. But in terms of a 3 minute time interval, which would be equivalent to, I guess, about 9 minutes if it was a 3-to-1 compression, what kind of handling would you be doing? Are you just operating a single locomotive? Are you operating multiple locomotives? Are you controlling the turnouts over this period? Are there people that are delivering locomotives full of ore cars to you? Describe what your particular operation was like.
Okay. In my case, the Beltline Extra, I had to pick up an engine at the roundhouse, take it to the servicing track. It was an SW1200, I believe, in the cream and maroon colors of the TH&B. And once I'd finished the servicing simulating the servicing at the roundhouse, well, you
certainly.
Know, this is artistic license.
Certainly. Did it have sound?
Some of the engines have sound in them. Some of them don't. John has a particularly large fleet. I think the roundhouse itself is almost a half circle of building, but the tracks go all the way around, and they're more than full of engines.
Gosh.
There's often two engines on each track. And not all. Some of the steamers have full sound systems, and a couple of the diesels have full sound systems, but he hasn't managed to get through all of them yet. I imagine that's a tremendous expense if you really want to get into the tsunamis and have the best quality audio. But for the moment, I was able to run out onto the main with the switcher and back into the yard to pick up half of the 22 cars that were set aside for my job. So I had to be in real life, the switcher would have only been able to pull 11 or 12 cars. So I had to limit the cut. I couldn't take them all at once, even though the model, the Cat Hill locomotive, could have pulled them all. So moving across the main line, obeying the line side signals, both dwarf and on the posts, and moving through the Hunter Street yard, going down into the helix, and coming into the hidden staging, this probably took on the order of 5 real minutes, so about 15 minutes on the fast clock.
Gosh.
And, well, you can't, you're under slow orders through the station areas. You have to take the secondary tracks. You can't come through on the passenger tracks, of course.
So while and, we're doing this, there are trains coming through.
Oh, yeah, there's passenger trains that are traveling from the far end of staging, which represents off-scene destinations to through the scene and onto the staging at the other end. This is actually pretty much a club-sized layout, but it's built in someone's basement as a private layout. And on a guess, I would say there's probably 250, 280 turnouts on the layout just for the various yards and sidings. That's the ones I could reasonably count. There might be more. There's probably 60 engines and several hundred cars. The one staging yard was immense. It probably consumed a couple hundred cars just by itself now that I think about it. But so you've got all your passenger traffic and other freight trains doing movements through the area while you're trying to move. So if you're coming on a diamond, you might have to stop for a through freight from a line that has superior rights, like the Canadian Pacific. It's surprising how long it takes to do all your movements back and forth. When you're coming back light, you might have to pick up cars at an industry and deliver them to another yard for either breaking down into an assignment to other trains or indeed delivering them to their final destinations if they're on the way. But in about 3 minutes of real time, you'll pick up your engine and couple up to the train and, let's say, simulate pumping up the air and being ready to depart from the position you're in onto your destination, getting obviously permission from the yard master in wherever you happen to be.
Fascinating. We have a question from Matt Goodman in the chat. Is there a set time that you must allow for servicing on the fast clock?
I would assume that if you're doing it strictly by the book, yes, there would be a set time that you'd have to say 3 minutes to enable you to take on fuel and sand in the case of a diesel, or water in the case of water and sand in the case of steamer. As long as you don't jump your start time, if you're scheduled to depart at, let's say, 1300 hours, then really you shouldn't leave your yard area until the fast clock has hit 1300.
And it sounds like there's so much going on around you, you can probably pause to anticipate some of the through traffic that's coming as well by the sound of things. It sounds like good aerobic exercise. I mean, in terms of moving between points and these kind of things, it sounds like there's a lot going on. In terms of the trains that pass you and go through your particular section, is the layout sufficiently big that there'll be some trains that you only see once in the operating session?
It depends. Depends on who you talk to, whether the layout is big enough or not. I think John doesn't think it's big enough to do the job, because when I was talking to him, he says, yeah, well, I had to compress it here and compress it there. He's got all the tracks in place, but not necessarily all the length. So he's limited to the distances between yards and distances between turnouts in the yard itself. So I think from a logistics standpoint, he's managed to capture the operations almost dead on to what's going on in 1952 in Hamilton, Ontario. In terms of is it big enough, because of the nature of the arrangement, there are a couple of duck unders, and there are a couple of areas where you have to bend down to access the staging yards that are underneath the main deck. And as you get older, that becomes less and less appealing, I think. But it's a compromise. It's one of those compromises you invariably seem to have to make in the hobby in order to fit in all of the bits that you want. With regard to Matt's question, from a servicing perspective, if you were to connect up to a train of cars, for one of the things you have to do in the real life is to pump up the brake system. That is to pressurize the brake system to release all the brakes. And the longer the line is, the longer the number of cars that you have on the train, the longer that's going to take. I suppose there's probably a formula that would allow you to calculate that, but I think that even for me, that's getting way too detail-oriented to bother with. So there is a reasonable delay while you hook up. You don't just simply hook up to a train of 20 cars and pull away. You have to give a bit of perspective time, I suppose.
And in terms of the size of the layout, is it a kind of layout where while you're moving in the same kind of area, you will only see one train? Are there any trains that you only see once through a standard operating session going through your part of the layout?
Oh, definitely. If you have a scheduled passenger train, for instance, that's on a timetable, say the 6 p.m. train that's supposed to arrive at the Hunter Street station, I mean, that'll enter the scene, stop at the station, and wait until its scheduled departure time, and then move off to either another staging yard or another station. And that will, I think John Armstrong referred to that as being sincere. The train only passes once through a scene, and it only passes through on its scheduled appearance, as opposed to going around and around in a displayer loop. Yeah, so passenger trains only appear once. Scheduled freights only appear once. The only time you'll see the same engine more than once is if it's a yard shunter or one of the transfer engines that's going from yard to yard.
And in terms of the industries, primarily you mentioned the steel layout. What are the other industries that are on the layout?
GE of Canada had a very large factory that produced transformer coils and lighting system components for high tension. So you can see movements that involve large oversized loads on depressed center flat cars in and out. A lot of steel, like ore processing and stamping mills, rolling mills in Hamilton. Plus, at one point, there was shipyards, that is building ships. Well, the gamut of industries, there was cold storage and icing for livestock and reefers. You'd have to have areas set aside for dealing with livestock movements in and out for slaughterhouses and reefers moving out with perishable goods, icing platforms and whatnot. So the big industries are all represented on John's layout, and as well as some of the residential scenes. So there are residential streets where in some places, Hamilton has or had some things that would be considered street running parallel to the paved roads that the automobiles would use. Also, another big industry in Hamilton is National Steel Car, which produces railway cars and has done for, 60, 70 years.
Fascinating. So in terms of folk, I know we have Matt Goodman in the chat, and he's in the process of creating, if not an empire layout, at least a mini empire layout. In terms of folk who are in the process of planning an empire layout, what can they learn from the layout that you operated on today?
Well, everyone is going to have their own preferences and own desires when they envision a layout. As I'm approaching 45 years of age here, the things that I took away from the layout are that I don't want any duck unders and I don't want any hidden staging. It's necessary in the space that John has available in order to fully model what he's trying to do in terms of the movement of trains. But in my case, at home, I'm going to go to great lengths to eliminate anything that forces me to either limbo under a lift-out section or kneel down and stick a pool cue in to try and move a train that's down in hidden staging.
Basically, the layout needs to be on not necessarily just a single level layout, but something that is easy to move around. And in terms of large operating sessions, did the layout that you operated on today, were there any things to kind of ease the ability of multiple people to move past each other with a wide aisle links or things like that?
There were a couple of areas where John has made kind of a grow out in the aisle. That is, the aisle becomes bulbous in one section to allow two people to pass. But largely, getting past one person or another involves inhaling a lot. And, you know, this can make for some interesting situations, especially since, well, as we're getting older, I think we're getting wider. And the one thing that you really need to consider when you're designing and building a layout is aisle space. You can't build an aisle wider. You can build the benchwork wider to accommodate an extra siding, but it's awfully hard to go the other way around and make the aisles wider at the expense of your modeled scene.
Certainly. So that would be stellar advice for anyone who is planning on creating one of these empire layouts, I'm assuming.
You wanna plan, if you're thinking of having a layout that's going to take you 15 or 20 years to build, think about what you're going to look like 15 or 20 years from now, and maybe some of the limitations you might be forced to live with. And don't make something that's going to become a burden to you in the future. And, you know, I can't say anything bad about John's layout. I had an awful lot of fun of running at John's, but for myself, I'm going to make something that basically has no aisles. I'm going to try an L-shaped layout and keep things as simple as possible and minimalist as possible. And for that, I'm going to have some compromises to the size of the scene and what can be included.
And some feedback from the chat. Matt Goodman asked, what are the minimum aisle widths on his layout, the layout you operated on today? And you responded, 24 inches. That seems extraordinarily tight.
It is. trust me, it's very, very tight. You don't walk down straight. You kind of walk edgewise or crab fashion in some spots. There's only a couple of places where it's like that, and for the most part, it's closer to 36 inches as a minimum width. But that's, yeah, Matt, it's just at the bottlenecks that it necks down to 24, and that's to allow for more trackage on the deck to give you that minimum space.
But it's a double-edged sword, because through the sections of more trackage, you would also imagine there would be more transitory people.
You are absolutely right. I think that if I was to hazard a guess, I think John has one regret in that there are 2 yards that are located on opposite sides of the same aisle. And in that case, it's really hectic because you have 2 yard masters and usually 2 people coming in and out of either yard. And that makes for an extremely crowded section. I'm sorry.
Yes, yeah, it sounds like an interesting experience. So the feedback with regards to the L for this kind of operating layout, if you had a around the edges of a room kind of shelf-style layout, I guess that would also give the same kind of effect that an L would give you in terms of the ability for people to move around in relative comfort. From the area that you're describing building in, however, there is a potential for other things to kind of take up areas which would limit the L in some places too. So I guess it really is a long-term planning project if you're thinking of doing something within 15 years. In terms of the discussion associated with aisle width and what will you look like in 15 years' time, scale has to factor into that as well. I think certainly my own experience with N, I don't know what I'll look like in 15 years, but projecting ahead, I'm going to be quite a failing, frail person, even in my kind of late 40s, if my deterioration continues at the rate it has to date. So I guess scale is also part of that, that when you're considering building an empire layout, if you're in your, you know, 30s or early 40s, then maybe N might appeal. But if you're doing this over such a length of time, obviously, perhaps you may consider bumping a scale. Is that something that you'll consider? I mean, you're starting with a relatively eye-friendly scale, aren't you?
Yeah, I like to think that S is more visually friendly, as you say. In the case of something like N scale or HO scale, if you're going to do switching operations, if you're doing display as your choice, then you're not so concerned with the car numbers and car reporting marks. But if you're trying to do operations in something like HO or N scale, and you have the layout at the, let's say, 48 or 44-inch level off the floor, in order to see the reporting marks, sometimes you have to get your eyes close to the cars. And in most cases, people tend to bend over. Well, bending over in an aisle tends to block the aisle completely. And if you're going to do something where you want a lot of operation, I would think bringing the trains up closer to your eye level, regardless of the scale, frankly, is going to give you a better perspective view on the situation.
So we have feedback from the chat. Matt Goodman on his layout is planning a bottleneck at 30 inches. My reading associated with the kind of standard thinking in the hobby is that 3 feet, 36 inches is pretty well the standard minimum. And what you're describing in terms of having multiple operators moving past each other in different directions makes me think that probably even 4 feet would be the right amount if you had, say, three operators that needed to get through a space going in different directions. What would your own preference be, Chris, if you were planning an aisle style layout and you knew that you were going to have three operators moving through a section?
I would tend towards the 4 foot or 5 foot width for an aisle. But the thing you have to remember, or one of the factors you have to take into consideration, is you're not modeling aisles. You're modeling a railroad, and there are people out there who will sacrifice everything in order to get the most track in the space that they can. But if you're planning to do a display layout, then that's not so bad because you're not staying in one spot for any particular length of time. You're kind of moving from one end to the other, following a train, watching it, as opposed to stopping and switching. So you don't tend to get the bottlenecks that you do when people are performing prototype moves. So you can get away with slightly smaller aisles, especially if it's a linear layout. People will tend to move from one end to the other. For myself, like I said, I would tend towards the 4 foot because my predilection is for an operating scheme. In the case of an L-shaped layout, it's no big deal. The rest of the room is the aisle. It's not a problem. If I was to move to a U-shaped layout, that is having a layout on three sides of an open space, I would make it a minimum of 4 feet between the fascias along the long edges of the U, if that makes sense. Just so you get two people in there without constantly bumping into one another or backing into one another.
Certainly. I mean, I think part of the model railroading hobby is losing yourself in the environment. And certainly if you're constantly worried about where other people are and how you're moving and these kind of things, you may lose a connection to the hobby that you would have if the aisles were properly designed. So I think this is probably critical feedback for those who are planning empire layouts or even layouts in relatively confined spaces. If they plan on multiple folks operating on the layout, that they need to consider the maximum, or in this case, minimum wiggle room possible between these aisles. Moving on to the Facebook group, I'm just looking at some new members of the Facebook group. Do you know Anthony Smith? He appears to be walking the streets at 2 a.m. and listening to the podcast when he's on night patrol. I guess I'm assuming he's a police officer or a security guard or something like that. Is he someone you know?
Not personally, no, but I'm glad there's somebody out there staying awake with the contents of Model Rail Radio rather than falling asleep.
Very good, very good. So a shout-out to Anthony Smith. Thank you very much for signing up to the Facebook group and posting that we keep you awake. And also to Roger Poplar, who's getting into the hobby and also new to the podcast. So he's using his brother as motivation. His brother, his brother's American Flyer train, actually. And so he just sends out a shout out saying that he's enjoying the podcast very much and it's working as inspiration for him. And for folks who are on Facebook who listen to the podcast, please consider joining the podcast group on Facebook. The previous podcast, we actually had some questions on the Facebook group, but this seems to be more shout-outs. And a question from Daniel Vamos with regards to me actually unifying my various hobbies, like unified theory and physics. I don't know if it's a great truth, but it's a great way of appeasing, what would one call them, domestic management, let's put it that way. So if one can unify the hobbies, it's oftentimes a good way of getting things through domestic management. So in terms of the mailing list traffic, it's been a relatively quiet couple of weeks. We have had a few posts from Matt Goodman. Following the last show, I'm not sure whether it was exactly after the last show or a few days following the last show, I posted my layout plans for what's looking like a OO simple short line layout, probably somewhere in the 30s to the 50s, depending on what I end up using as a switching loco. But the layout got some feedback from Matt Goodman in particular. I know Matt's in the chat too, so maybe he can talk to the feedback as I offer it. The layout that I had developed was inspired by a UK Model Rail magazine in terms of the fact that there were no switchbacks, or as they say in the UK, looperouts. And I didn't necessarily think it was going to be a particularly controversial layout, but Matt pointed out that the layout appeared to need switchbacks. And certainly for the area that I was looking to do, the kind of Lake District area, which is if you draw a line between Newcastle-upon-Tyne and I guess Cambridge, the Lake District is kind of in that area, kind of equidistant between those two places. It's on the eastern part of the UK, kind of midway up around the kind of, I guess, neck of the UK or some area like that. But anyway, it's a very beautiful area. It's quite mountainous. There are a number of industries, and you come, as you go over a hill, into these small plain areas which have these industries dotted. And my plan was to model one of these coming around a bend over a hill and seeing a small short line with the view that there would probably be a couple, maybe three or four industries on the short line and some kind of narrative associated, which is very much going back to the early, the start of this podcast series where I talked about this idea of the narrative layout. So having posted the layout, I had a good thought, in my own mind at least, that it was going to be an introductory DC, probably moving to DCC, possibly two trains at most, maybe three at a pinch. But the idea with regards to the no turnbacks, the no looparounds, is the idea that basically in the case of the layout that I'm designing, the locomotive is relatively small. It's probably, I can't think of an American locomotive of any real era that would be equivalent to either the steam or diesel offerings on these UK layouts in terms of the size. Chris, you're an expert of locos. Can you think of an American locomotive that would be as small as the kind of locomotives I'm talking about, the Terriers or the early diesel classes in the UK? Is there anything in the US equivalent?
In the U.S., you'd be looking at maybe a 23-ton GE end cab or a 44-ton GE center cab.
But they're still a bit bigger, aren't they?
Well, the 44-tonners are pretty decently sized. The 23s are literally about half of that size, on an 040 frame. And you're looking at Terriers and Pugs with 040 and 060 wheel arrangements, but shorty wheel bases and small diameter wheels for the shunting operations.
Certainly.
And even the jack shaft diesels that you're looking at are not going to be more than, say, a 30 ton kind of a size. And I guess Matt's primary consideration there is that for the posting that you made with Pasted Graphic 1, there is no way to get around to do delivery B along the vertical portion of the PDF, because you're kind of stuck behind. You can shunt actually three of the sidings, but two of the sidings you can't get to because the goods wagon would be behind the engine as you were maneuvering in.
Certainly. And here, because I did go back and look in terms of the prototypical, the way the engines were used, what comes up when you even search for these classes of engines, the Terriers, the Pugs, and the early diesel of similar size, is the engines pushed up as far as they can and to the end of the rail, and people offloading from exactly as Matt is describing what would previously be described as a kind of snooker situation, because you couldn't unload or you couldn't remove the car and then the train would go on its merry way. Prototypically, what happens is the train actually stops, and perhaps even the driver gets out and assists with some of the offloading in those circumstances as well. So the snookering aspect, I think it's probably a legacy of the kind of trains, the kind of short lines, and also the way the UK Rail has kind of both evolved and devolved, gone through periods of nationalisation, periods of degradation, periods of regionalisation, the history of UK Rail in terms of its transitions, and also the sheer volume of rail that existed around the period of nationalisation. Well, the two periods of nationalisation. I once saw an image of all the rail that had been laid prior to, I think, 1910, and the various transitions of nationalisation, how various aspects of the rail had been left. And you see this actually as you go through areas of the Midlands, across to Cambridge. You will stumble across these lines, which are clearly of that era and just exist as maybe 2 miles, 3 kilometres of track that run along existing track and then go off into thick forests of trees, thickets, these kind of things. You do get the sense that there is a lot more rail hidden in the UK than you use currently, and that is in fact very much the case. So my aim with regards to the short line is to take these prototypical aspects, and here I'm looking back at, I wish I had the magazine in front of me so I could quote it, a magazine article from about a year and a half ago now, associated with these kind of short lines that prototypically don't have these kind of loop arounds. Primarily because, as I said, the engine stops and the folks who are unloading the engine unload the goods, and then the engine starts back up and backs out of the track. So what you see in the US with regards to both size and also the layout of the rail, obviously now in the UK there's a kind of unified, internationalized method with regards to these kind of problems, and there are these kind of loop arounds, obviously, in the UK still. You can look very easily on Google Maps, and I know I've had correspondence with Duncan McCree. He follows a wide variety of lesser-known routes in the UK and occasionally finds steam locomotives or other kinds of curious locomotives on the tracks through the Google satellite map view. So you can get a sense of the amount of rail that is actually in the UK, even on these rusting roads. But the one point that the article did make is it has a, I'm not sure what the technical term is, but a bit of track basically with a pivoting joint about two-thirds of the way down the track that moves between two separate lines as a kind of off-staging turning. But it's only moving the trains from two separate lines. It isn't a rotating, like a roundhouse kind of situation. It's
a spectra plate.
Yes, exactly. So that was the only non-prototypical thing they included on their layout. It was a considerably larger layout, but it contained the same kind of elements that I am having in mind in terms of relatively small industries, somewhat hilly. I can't recall if theirs was based in the Lake Country or whether it was based in Wales. Some of the Welsh railroads have similar kinds of styles. But my point back to Matt was that, firstly, it is prototypical, and secondly, you can't think about US rail on international railroads. You can't assume that the kind of standards and the methods that are used in the US, particularly as we've described with regards to the standard larger train formats that are used here and also the much larger distances, that the same kind of methods will be used in other countries. And I think the thing that I like particularly about this area, this period, and what I'm hoping to do with this layout is it will be something that is very quintessentially of the Lake Country, very quintessentially the Lake District, sorry, as they call it, and very much of the style of coming over a hill and seeing one of these, short lines. My thinking is also that I may actually model some of the rusting older line through some of the sections to hint that basically this is a division of rail that has taken some kind of point of nationalizing and made it more interesting. So it's still a layout in progress. We have folk in the chat posting various things as well. But I'll give feedback as I go through. And my thinking is currently to do DC with the kind of possibilities in terms of obviously just my own operation. It's just above my computer table, so it will be kind of late evening operation. But with the view that when the trains come to the end of the track, I will simulate the offloading and simulate the various time that is allowed, and also probably put industries that lend themselves to these kind of things. So the photographs that I've seen, well, really, there are a number of industries that seem to be supported by these kind of short line movements, and also the ability for the engine to come to rest and then whatever is on the engine to be unloaded and then the engine to move backwards, back up the line. But as I'm thinking currently, there'll probably be something involving crates of some description, possibly a dairy, and possibly some kind of, I don't know. I'm still thinking of the possible industries that the layout lends itself to. But that's my progress in terms of planning and just general discussion through the mailing list. In addition to this, Matt posted a little bit with regards to the discussion that we had last time on using Sprint or Agile development methodologies and also mind maps. Do you want to talk a little bit about the mind mapping, Chris?
Well, I had I managed to spend some time doing some mind mapping with regard to the outdoor layout. But due to just the press of daily life, I wasn't able to go through and do all the exercises I wanted to. The mind mapping that I did actually kind of clarified a few items for me.
Can you describe the process for the listeners?
Well, it's the way I understood it. It was to start with a central idea, the overriding idea, and describing each subsection of that idea as you branch off and work down to the sort of the smallest component of the idea. For instance, I have an outdoor railway that I want to do, and one of the factors in that is actually the track bed itself, and I need to develop obviously a track plan to do that. So that is the overall idea in the center of the page is the outdoor layout, and one of the long branches that comes off is the alignment of the track. And in order to establish the alignment of the track, I have to set down or survey a route in the garden. So that's another branch that comes off. That is to survey the route. In order to survey the route, I need to know one thing. I need to know is how much track I'm actually going to lay. So I have to have ordered the track or decided upon the track. So as each idea goes down into its smaller and smaller causal nature of each idea, it's helping me to define the things that I've done and that I haven't done, and where my where the gaps are that I've left in the planning and the execution. It's devilishly hard in retrospect to try and describe this using your hands over the radio. So I'm going to have to put a sketch out, I suppose, in either the Picasa site or something, a link to it, so that the people can see what I mean. But it's breaking down a problem into smaller and smaller parts. It's almost like building a pyramid with the central idea at the peak and then building in all of the components of it underneath, and it kind of branches off and gives you more and more granularity as you go down to the base of the pyramid. I'm supposing that's might be a reasonable analogy, but Matt seems to have either taken exception or agreed with me. I'm not sure with his
comment. I think it's an agreement that you can't actually show what you're describing very well over the radio.
It's like describing a spiral staircase without using your hands. Yeah.
Exactly. But I think what you're describing here is also compatible with the discussion that we had with Agile, the Agile methodology in planning your hobby. And really, as you say, it's this idea of starting with the big things and then cutting it down into things which are not only manageable, but are easily conceivable. And certainly the feedback that that Matt Goodman gave with regards to his day job, and this certainly is in some regard applicable to mine as well, is the idea that what this was used to tackle previously was things that just seemed absolutely mind-blowing, in fundamental sense, inventions, ideas which didn't exist and needed some way of creating them with an existing set of knowledge that would have initially been thought to have been not enough in order to create these things. And I think the metaphor with regards to a layout, and particularly as one creates layouts which are different or perhaps larger or perhaps more complicated or in a different scale or different era or require new modeling techniques or potentially structures that are larger and more elaborate than ones that have been built previously, this kind of technique really lends itself to those kind of problems too, this idea that really, you have skill sets that you don't know. It's just a matter of kind of atomizing the problem to the point where your skill set can latch on. And I think what you're describing with regards to your garden layout in particular is exactly the way this should be done. In terms of your summer and your plans with regards to the garden layout over the summer, it's quite hot here in Las Vegas today. I mean, it's uncomfortably hot to podcast without the air conditioner on currently. What's the weather report like in your part of the world, and how will that impact what you do this summer on the garden layout?
We had ice rain today. I drove through an ice rain storm this morning on the way to the show. And it was pretty darn cold all day. It needed a thermal vest at least, and a long sleeve shirt and a hat just to be less uncomfortable than you would be without those things.
Certainly, certainly. So in terms of your garden layout, you're really talking it's starting in possibly a month and a half, a couple of months' time, just to avoid these kind of weather conditions.
Well, I understand that the rail has arrived somewhere in New York State that I had ordered, and at some point in the very near future, a couple of the reprobates, I mean the friends that I have up here, are going to wander down on another mission, and in the course of their activities, they're going to pick up that rail and track and bring it back to me. So I think the first week of May, maybe the second week of May, I'll have it. But as I've mentioned earlier, I really don't have the plan together yet for how I'm going to support the track in an elevated fashion so that I'm not constantly kneeling down to work on the steam engines. It's a bit difficult because as I walk out to the area, one of the areas I'd really like to have the track is under the willow tree, but willow trees wanting or thriving in wet ground, it's showing me how badly mushy it is in that area. And, of course, if you have a rainstorm, it's going to be a couple of days before it dries out underneath the willow, so I can't. That kind of obviates the use of that space after a rainstorm, so I'm going to have to move it out from under the willow, which kind of limits some of the places I wanted to go.
Certainly.
While still maintaining
certainly
shade.
In terms of the actual track itself, you described needing some friends in order to go and pick it up. How much track have you ordered? How much does it weigh? What does it look like? And are you going to be hand laying it?
Well, I really seriously debated hand laying the track outside, and I was, let's say, convinced otherwise. I could spend my time cutting ties and laying track, or I could spend my time running the trains. And what I ended up doing is from Sunset Valley Railway, I ordered 120 feet of their gauge O track, so the 32-millimeter gauge, narrow gauge track. And that comes on UV-resistant tie strips. And each section is about 6 foot long. Each section of rail is 6 foot long, and the tie strips are about 1 foot long each. So you have to pre-bend the rail in this case to get it to roughly the radius that you want it before you attach the tie strips and then attach them down to your sub-roadbed, whatever base you're going to use. Whether it's elevated planking or decking or whatnot. I thought about buying some cedar deck boards and chopping them up, running them through the table saw and chopping them into appropriately sized tie pieces, and then maybe using some pressure-treated, like Thompson's water seal or something on them, but frankly, the way my schedule is, I would never get to that this year. So having the track ready-made is going to be, I think, an easier way for me to get running in the next 365 days anyway.
So this seems almost like an equidistant point between hand-laying and standard rail. Can you just describe the process? You actually bend the rails and then attach the ties?
Yeah, you have to, you can use a 3-point rail bender. It's essentially three bearings in a triangular shaped jig, and you can adjust one of the bearings to give you effectively different degrees of pressure on the rail as you feed it through. Again, difficult to explain in words. I will try and post a picture of it, and that'll help an awful lot. It's available for the smaller scales as well. You can get rail benders from a couple of companies, including Fast Tracks, to pre-bend rail to various radii. But essentially, you'll get close to what you want in terms of the finish radius, and then you can slip the tie strips on from the end, either end of the rail. The tie strips have a web down the center of them with countersunk holes to allow you to attach that to a piece of either planking or deck board, or sink a screw into concrete. Tapcons are good screws for going directly into concrete. And then you can ballast over, and that webbing is hidden from sight.
Interesting. So returning to the problems, the actual water logging problems and other issues associated with putting it in a real garden, I guess this is a regular railroad problem. I mean, this is something that obviously normal railroads have to deal with as well, in terms of a wide variety of runoff situations, sodden land, these kind of things. Do you see yourself actually making alterations to the garden for the layout, significant alterations, or do you see yourself perhaps laying crushed rocks or something like that in order to alleviate these kind of sodden ground issues? What's your thinking in terms of what you'll need to do?
Well, since we have snow a good number of the months of the year, I'm going to have to consider the frost line. So anything, if I'm sinking posts into the ground, they're going to have to go 3 or 4 feet down to get below the frost line. And I'm still debating doing fence posts and cement, or driving in the T-posts using a sliding ram that you'd use for, say, either cattle fencing or barbed wire or something to protect an auto yard or something like that. It's really, again, it's one of those things, I haven't done it before, so there's going to be an awful lot of experimentation. I've seen what some people do or have done, which is to drive the fence posts into the ground, just sharpen the end of them and hammer them in with a heavy weight or the mallets. I've seen people set them right on top of the ground in concrete post holders and then connect everything together above ground using cross bracing, almost like a truss bridge. Then as the ground heaves, you get some variation in height over time, which in some cases is easy to correct, in some it's not. But if you were to put down, dig down, say, 8 inches, put in sand and gravel screening, and then put a patio stone on top of that, and put your posts rising up from the top of the patio stone using one of the concrete post bases, that's a fairly stable, well-drained kind of a arrangement to make. But you really have to have your track plan nailed down absolutely, because this is earth moving. This isn't just, oh, I'll pick up this spike and move it over here. You're in for a few afternoons of heavy shoveling to get your bases in at the various points. Even if you're not going to dig post holes and pour concrete, it still represents a significant amount of effort, physical effort, and not an inconsiderable amount of alteration to your garden space. And again, it's yet to be determined whether the trains will actually run through the flower beds in the backyard, or they're going to be separate from it. Unfortunately, what we have in the backyard, we've been finding, is a number of improvised impediments. They're rocks and cinder blocks and bricks buried in the ground for whatever reason, and bits of metal posts driven into the ground to act as bracing for things that, I don't know, probably disappeared 20 years ago from the property itself, but they're a hazard to both your lawnmowers and your ankles if you're walking around, because you'll hit a spot that's rock hard next to a section that's soft from the rain. And we've been trying to dig those out and collect up all the rubble, and it's actually turning into a fairly decent-sized pile of former sedimentary material here. And I'm wondering if I can use that somehow in the construction of the outdoor railroad. And it, so far it escapes me how to use it without making it look like a junkyard.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's just the nature of being a new homeowner. Certainly we've had similar experiences. In fact, we're still fighting with that exactly that problem. But what you're describing, I'm going to ask a blushing question here. What's the importance of the frost line?
Well, the problem with items in an area where you have a frost line is that anything above the level of the frost line that's in the ground, as the ground freezes, this solid object, whether it's a bit of concrete or a wooden post, will get shoved up by a measurable amount during the freezing process, and then during the thawing process in the spring, it will tend to get sucked back down, but it doesn't go back where it started from. So over the course of a year or two, you can end up with something that looks like a demented spider built your backyard garden accessories, whether it's a fence or a deck or something like that. If you don't take into account that the ground is going to alter in shape quite a bit during the freezing process, then you're going to be very disappointed come the springtime.
Gosh. So it's not really a situation where you can do any kind of just precursorily cover, you know, the area under the willow, for example, with small rocks and then build on top of that. You really need to have something which is grounded below the frost line and also, I guess, allows for frequent maintenance and adjustment, which probably is the interesting thing with regards to thermal expansion and what sounds like probably fast thermal contraction as well. So you're really almost dealing with two separate fluid layers when you start planning the garden layout from what you're describing.
Yeah, I either have to solidly embed it well below the affected layer, which in our area is about 3 feet deep, or I have to make it float entirely on top of the ground and make it incredibly easy to adjust come springtime. And there are benefits to both approaches, but at the moment, as I've said, I'm at a bit of a loss which one to take, which one's going to prove to be the least amount of trouble for the long run and the most robust. At some point in time, we're probably going to move away from this location, and I don't want to have some permanent edifice like Stonehenge in the backyard that's going to be a detriment to the sale, right? I have to be able to return it to its former pastoral glory, right, without looking like it's been through a war.
Certainly. So the option really is floating above for all but a few critical points from what you're describing.
Yeah, probably the most important point to have is as rigid and solid as the steaming bay, which will have to have two or three tracks available to put engines on to get them boiled up. And the rest of it I can probably manage. Well, yes, I'm going to float my roadbed, I suppose, Matt. But they also send out entire road crews to reline it and tamp the ballast and fix the pulled spikes and everything every spring. So it doesn't matter which way you go. There's going to be a certain amount of physical labor at the outset, and there's going to be a certain amount of labor every year to look after it. And that's just the way it is. And I guess if I don't like that, I'm kind of pursuing the wrong hobby. But I'm one of those people that will tend to agonize over these decisions until somebody finally comes and says, well, let's get on with it. They'll show up with a case of beer, a pot of chili, and some picks and shovels, and I guess we'll go at it, which isn't, I suppose, a bad way to do it.
Certainly, certainly. So it sounds like you're probably going to be doing a floating layout. This is for your live stream too, isn't it?
Yep, this will be for the live stream.
So, Chris, I understand that you also went to an Arrogage train show today. I understand that it's completely overwhelmed you sensorially and in terms of topics for Model Rail Radio, possibly giving you a number of possibilities. What would you like to talk about specifically associated with the show today, and what benefit do you think would give to the Model Rail Radio listening audience?
Well, I think one of the things that I wanted to articulate based on this show is that this was created by a small group of volunteers who were bemoaning the lack of a narrow gauge specific show north of the border. And I guess about 6-7 years ago now, the fire got up to a sufficient heat that everyone decided that they were going to finally arrange their own show, a single day show, and see how it went. So today was the 5th annual show, and I would have to say it was a successful show. There were probably on the order of 120 guests, maybe a little more, over the course of the day. And while that may not seem like a lot, a couple of points I'll make later will illustrate why that was significant. It's held, oddly enough, in a small town about an hour north of the city, so it's not a big venue. It's a community center. And the idea was to promote narrow gauge modeling in general and some of the Canadian prototypes specifically, but not exclusively, and to provide a forum for people to have contests and sort of a peer review of their models, as well as a venue for clinics for instruction. For instance, today there were four clinics. The first one was on the trains software simulator, specifically how that related to modeling long gone narrow gauge prototypes like the main two footers, of which there are a number of simulation components available on the web. And secondly, the owner of Mount Albert Scale Lumber, Jerry Cornwell, was there giving his Wood 101 seminar on the uses of basswood for construction of models. Following that, there was an excellent clinic on weathering wood, techniques for dyeing, staining, distressing, painting, and otherwise making wood appear realistic in the structure itself by Larry McDonald. And finally, a clinic that I'd been looking forward to for some time and have managed to miss the last three times it was presented, by a friend of mine, Jim Martin, on painting backdrops for your layout. So over the course of 6 hours, there were four very detailed and very good clinics, again, all put on by volunteers for the benefit of their peer group. This isn't like the NMRA putting this on, or the great train shows of America, or the other professional or show organizers whose sole purpose it is to go around and organize various train shows or toy, doll, and collector shows or whatnot. So this is really for enthusiasts, by enthusiasts, again, and it shows in the turnout and the general enthusiasm and demeanor of the people there attending. So people like Master Model Railroader Clark Cooning was there demonstrating constructing fast tracks, jigs, turnouts using the jigs. Clark is a member of Tim Waris's team at Fast Tracks and happens to be local to this area. He's also the reason I'm in S-Scale as well, due to a conversation that occurred about 10 years ago now that he doesn't seem to remember, but is...
that impacted you, clearly.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be blamed for it, apparently, that I'm in S-Scale now. And it was one of the most incredible things that happened at the show today was during the award ceremony at the end. The award for best diorama, best in show, and the best use of wood, the last award was given by Jerry Cornwell of Mount Albert Scale Lumber, were all awarded to a young fellow of less than 20 years of age who made one of the most beautiful dioramas that I've seen in a long time. Just amazing quality workmanship from a young person showing extreme dedication to what they're doing. And that really kind of boded well for, gave me the impression that we've got a good future in model railroading, because it's not all the young people that are ignoring this. It's there are some out there who are willing to put the time in to do a good job and learn the skill set required to well, frankly, beat out a lot of guys who have been in the hobby for a long time and do fine work themselves.
What did he actually build specifically?
The scene was of a workshop junkyard area, probably on the order of 18 inches by 26 inches in size, with several small buildings and just an incredibly well-detailed set of small vignettes within the scene. And I'm going to post some photographs of it. It's almost impossible to describe it. There's so many things going on in the scene, and I hope that the lighting was sufficient for me to capture it. I was having a heck of a time with the camera today, but I think that that's more my fault than the camera's fault. But I mean, not alone to see this, to see the work that people are putting out in the contest room with the engines, the rolling stock, the dioramas, the structures, and then the layouts, the micro layouts and mini layouts that were on display throughout the hall, is really stunning. The quality of work put out by the amateurs in this hobby is just continues to amaze me. And everything from wood to water and from mechanical to organic is being done at such a high level. You know, the layouts that we idolized from 20 years ago in Model Railroader don't compare in the same way today because of the materials and techniques that are being used. I'm sure in 20 years, the railroads of today are going to pale by comparison to what people are achieving. It's just incredible.
Certainly. If we can take a step back 5 years ago when this show first started, you've described a little bit of the motivation in terms of just a kind of critical mass of hobbyists being in a particular area. Do you think this show is really applicable internationally? Could folks in a wide variety of areas consider doing this kind of show? And in terms of the, you mentioned Fast Track, but in terms of the manufacturers coming to this kind of show, was there a heavy manufacturer presence? And have you been to all the five previously? And were there manufacturers at all of them? Or was there a critical point where the manufacturers did actually show up too?
I was at the first two, and this one here. I missed the third and fourth shows for various reasons of timing. At the beginning, there was a good buy-in from local manufacturers, especially from people like Jerry at Mount Albert Scale Lumber, Chris Creighton at Schomburg Scale Models, Pete Reisiger at Creative 3D Design, Barry McClelland at Railway Recollections. I mean, there's a number of people here locally that do resin castings, hydrocal castings. They make wood, laser cut wood kits and parts. They do custom painting. They do layout design and construction. There's a company that does custom layouts that was at the show, and one of their layouts won Best Micro today. So is there a critical mass? Is there a critical point? I think the critical point comes from the interested parties that want to do this, and they're not doing it. They're not doing this for profit. It's all a not-for-profit arrangement. The proceeds from today's show goes to the rental of the hall, the insurance for the hall, and a few incidental items like badges and tickets and whatnot. But today they were able to give donations to both the Friends of the East Broadtop, which is a preservation society that had representatives here today for for their display, and the Huntsville and Lake of Bays Railway Society, which is another preservation group for a local historical railway that operated in the 30s through the 50s in Ontario. And not insignificant donations were made by the by the show organizers today to these preservation societies, simply because that's what they want to do with the proceeds. They're not interested in lining their own pockets with it, but they're going out to keep what little narrow gauge equipment is out there running and in a fit state for people to come and look at it and appreciate for future generations, which frankly is the big thing that I took away today, was that these guys are doing it because they love the trains, they love the hobby, they love the idea of history staying alive. And for any group in any area, whether it's in the UK, which has a tremendous preservation movement already, or in Australia or the United States, or indeed in Europe, anyone, anywhere can arrange a show of various success levels if they have the drive to do the job. And it takes probably six or seven people to arrange the facilities, to schedule the event, to get to track down the people who will be clinicians, to track down the layouts who will be on display, to track down the vendors who are going to come and sell their product. And every area has something to offer in all of those aspects. So anybody can do this, and it can be on any theme. It doesn't have to be narrow gauge. It could be for a particular era or a particular it could be all diesels, it could be all steam, it could be all the New York Central guys getting together, all the Penzi guys getting together, all the Great Western people in England. I'm sure that happens. I'm sure there's rail line specific shows that go on every year, but even a small community can raise some awareness for their own railway heritage and or create some revenue stream for their local museums, pioneer villages, and other historic features of their area by doing something like this. And it doesn't require the professionals to get involved in this. You can do it yourselves. I'm sure there are many business people out there who are involved in the hobby that can leverage their their knowledge and skill set and pull off exactly the same thing and possibly turn it into an annual or semi-annual event. I won't say it's easy. It requires a lot of work by people who are dedicated to the cause, but the rewards today, especially the look on the face of the person from the Huntsville and Lake of Bays Railway Preservation Society when he saw the big giant novelty check being presented and realized it wasn't a joke, that this is going to help towards the restoration of a number of their pieces of equipment. It was actually a very, very emotional moment for several people, I think, myself included.
Very good. Very good. So the blueprint is get together with six or seven local hobbyists, plan, invite, if there are local enterprises associated with the hobby, and also, as you say, find perhaps some local preservation, some local railway preservation groups, and this kind of creates the critical apex in terms of the necessary parties to create this kind of group. Do you get a sense of the amount of work that went in initially and the amount of work that is put in annually to put the show together?
I would say the volunteers probably put in order of 100 hours each in tracking down the various vendors and exhibitors and clinicians, plus arranging for the awards plaques and the hall rental and the local, in this case, the Lions Club Auxiliary came in to do the cooking. So there was hamburgers and hot dogs and sausages and fried onions and all that good stuff to really top off the day. Some people do this as a matter of course in their involvement in the hobby. I know that one of the primary people, the owner of Schomburg Scale Models, who really wanted this project to come about, he's tireless in his pursuit of promoting this event in general and the hobby specifically. At every show he goes to, he makes sure that he touches base with potential clinicians and exhibitors and vendors to say, we're having it again this year, and we have some space, and we'd really like you to bring your product and or yourself and talk about your experiences and where modelers can go with the ideas and what possible products they can use to duplicate the real thing. So, he's a special case. He's devoted to it because he loves the hobby. And I mean that in the ultimate way. He spends an inordinate amount of time, not to the exclusion of all else, but an inordinate amount of time doing things the right way. All of his product is of very high quality and shows that he's got attention to detail, and the events that he's involved in show the similar attention and desire to put out a good quality experience. So if you're going to get into this sort of thing because you think it's lucrative, it's not. You're not going to get rich. Most people are not going to get rich arranging model railway shows. They're going to do it because they want to do it and because it's the right thing to do in their area to promote the hobby. It's thankless. No matter what you do, somebody's going to complain that the prices are too high or there's not enough. Why am I paying $15 to see this? I can go somewhere else for $10 and be entertained. Well, it's a participatory hobby. It's an opportunity to meet and greet people you would not otherwise be able to mix with. simply because of proximity or time. Someone else has taken the made the effort to collect this vast group of to cull this vast group of people and bring them together in one spot to give you a good experience. And quibbling about a few dollars here and there, when I see what people pay for a Starbucks coffee in the morning, frankly, $15 to go to a show and be entertained for the whole day, or at least have the opportunity to interact with people for the whole day, is an incredibly small price to pay. But it doesn't matter. It's either too far away or too close to Easter or too close to some other event or not long enough or not short enough. Or no, it's amazing.
You can't keep everyone happy, clearly. In terms of the, I mean, we had the first ever model rail radio meetup at the Chicago O meet. You're talking about a narrow gauge meet. Is it a sense that the, the fringe is not the right term. The aspects of the hobby that are in particular niches seem to draw together enthusiasts that are so passionate that they put on these kind of shows. Do you get the sense, or I mean, I guess you're in a relatively good area in terms of the number of rail shows that are available to you. You seem spoiled for choice in various times of the year. Do you get a sense that the niche areas of the hobby tend to lend themselves towards these kind of organized shows, or do you see so many general shows in your area that this is in fact the exception rather than the norm?
Well, we have an awful lot of generic train shows where Thomas the Tank Engine is the matter of course rather than the special event. And where something like the O-scale meet or the narrow gauge meet or something like the Copetown show, which was primarily designed to promote Canadian prototype modeling and Canadian vendors, are their niche events. And yes, they will draw the passionate people because, frankly, in the niche areas, you'll find the people with the highest level of focus, I think. And with that brings a certain level of enthusiasm that you don't find in the general populace. So yeah, I will agree with your statement about the niche drawing the most passionate people. Yeah,
certainly. We have Andrew Chisholm in the chat. Geographically, Andrew Chisholm seems to be roughly in your area. Do you know Andrew? Do you know where he is? Do you get a sense? Because he talks about the same hobby stores that you refer to.
I've probably run into Andrew at some point in time, but without having name tags. I think all hobbyists should be forced to wear name tags at all times, not just at shows. That way, when we run into each other, we know who we are. Your name, your scale, your era, and
business
your
card. That's not necessary. Yeah. What needs to happen is you need to have hobby, you know, business cards in inverted commas that you can pass on, preferably with a photograph on you of you on the card as well. So I think that's the way that you could probably keep track. Andrew says he lives south of Ottawa.
Yeah, okay. That's probably about 5 hours drive from here.
Oh, okay. You mentioned faster. I guess the southern hobby stores. There was some overlap in your discussion of hobby stores as well.
Well, I've been up in that area to one particular hobby store in that area that I used to frequent when I traveled up to visit friends was called Larkspur Line, and it was in a tiny town just outside of Ottawa, and they always had a great selection of new stuff and estate items and out-of-production items that I guess had been horse-traded at one show or another. And I'm sure Andrew's been down here in Toronto to places like George's or Credit Valley, which are, again, they're sort of the mecca for hobbyists because they keep the most current stock of items and the highest amount of inventory compared to other places.
So Andrew is saying that he knows Trevor Marshall, who's good friends with Michael Butcher. Michael is one of Andrew's mentors in the hobby.
Ah, okay. Michel Boucher. Yeah. Well, Trevor used to live in Ottawa, so he was a member of the Ottawa Valley Association of Railroaders. And one of the things that they did as a group is they had a monthly dinner and clinic after dinner. So they would get together at one of the local hotels. They had a set meal, and a presenter would talk about whatever topic they'd arranged. And they could their fee structure was such that they could often offset some of the travel costs of getting the speakers to the dinners. So very nice. If your club is big enough to support that kind of activity, then or maybe you've got a small club, maybe 20, 25 people, it's still worth investigating having people come in from other areas to talk about different activities or different historic museum sites or preservation sites. And there you go.
Gosh, 180 people, Andrew says.
Yeah, that's...
The Ottawa Valley Associated Railroaders, or OVAR, 180 people.
Yeah, that's they're serious about modeling in the nation's capital.
Gosh, that's very impressive. He mentions that Lakesville Line is still a great store, and Andrew's wife says, "My money and my husband goes to Lakesville Line." Very good.
Yeah.
No, that's phenomenal. That's absolutely phenomenal. So I don't know how. I mean, I think about this with regards to Las Vegas, and I think about the potential of the local hobbyists and the problems that I've noted in previous model rail radios. But I don't know what creates. My sense has always been that you need to have a really solid middle class. You need to have people that have disposable income in order to have these kind of hobbies. And unfortunately, the area that I'm in, well, the people that do have the disposable income are in gated, fenced, armed, guarded communities, and they very rarely leave. So there's just not the same kind of community sense that would allow something like that to happen in Las Vegas. And I'm not sure, what's the general population of the area of Ottawa that Andrew's in? It'd be a couple of million?
Ottawa's probably less than a million.
Yeah.
The greater Toronto area, which I guess the area...
1 million, says Andrew.
Oh, well, yeah. Probably if you include all the areas around out to Pembroke and Petawawa, I suppose. But Toronto's probably 7 million from the greater area, out from the farthest reaches east, the farthest reaches west. Which, you know, when you consider that Canada's population is about the population of maybe California, and, you know, there's so much more density in the States in terms of the population in any given area, especially in a place like Springfield, where you can draw on several major cities of several million people each, all within about a 2.5 hour drive. That's where you get your critical mass, and you can hold a show that draws 100,000 people to it over the course of 2 days. We had maybe 120 people at the show today up north, and managed to pay for everything, plus be able to make donations to two worthy causes for preservation of equipment. The big shows that we have in the city draw, I don't know, probably in the order of 10,000, which is not a lot considering the population of the city. If you go to a show like Worley in England, you'll see 100,000 people in the course of the weekend. That's a show. I'd love to go there. Or even Expo Narrow Gauge in Europe, you'll see 20, 25,000 people at it.
Certainly. Certainly. Yeah, I think there are a number of factors, and Matt Goodman is kind of agreeing with me in the chat that the older neighborhoods, more stable, these kind of things will develop the support of the hobby. So, yes. Well, that sounds fascinating. In terms of folks listening into model rail radio, the narrow gauge element, I mean, we've talked about a wide variety of scales. The appeal for narrow gauge specifically, I'm assuming this was a number of different narrow gauge scales. It wasn't just ON30 or something like that. Every possible kind of narrow gauge scale was covered?
There are models there today from HON30 up to 7/8N2, which is quite large. That's almost 1 inch to the foot. The vast majority of that tends to fall in the ON30, ON3 sort of range. O-scale is a very popular size for narrow gauge modeling because you can end up with tremendous detail, and yet when you're modeling a small engine, it's still big enough to have sufficient mass to operate reasonably reliably. If you get down into the smaller scales, I've seen NN3 engines, but they're fiddly little things that most of the time can't pull the skin off a rice pudding. And up to the larger scales where you get into 7/8N2 garden, either electric or steam, and then, you're getting into a specialized sort of a skill set to be able to build things because you have to machine a lot of your components yourself.
And prototypically, narrow gauge also typically has tighter turns and things as well, doesn't it? I mean, going up hills and mountainous areas, the turns are prototypically tighter with narrow gauge. So in the smaller scales, that must be even more problematic.
Well, one of the nice things about choosing narrow gauge over standard gauge is that for a given layout room, for a given area that you can build in, you can get more railroad in the same space. Your turns can be tighter, your curves can, grades can be steeper without looking out of place. A lot of these, a lot of narrow gauge lines were extraction lines or mining, logging, industrial affairs. And from the standpoint of appeal, they tended to have more dilapidated equipment, more rundown line side structures, stuff that was more quaint or in some cases could be even considered whimsical or even in some ways caricatures of mainline railroading. And this appeals a lot to people with an artistic bent who want to explore highly detailed structures and highly detailed equipment that can be viewed up close and is not moving at mainline speeds. A lot of it moved really slowly, Shays and Heislers and Climax style, or vertical boilered grasshoppers or other engines that kept below 15 or 20 miles an hour to do their daily work. Because a lot of the engines were fairly small, when you're working in the larger scale, you still end up an engine that's 6 feet long, maybe a 5 or 6 ton engine that's less than 8 feet long, and in O scale it's only 2 inches. You're not modeling something that's a foot and a half that requires a 40 inch radius curve to go around, but you can still use all the very large doors and windows and figures. And you know yourself, Tom, from doing your war game miniatures, that the larger scale figures can offer a tremendous boost to the detail level that you can get, and you can actually start to put expressions on the faces in the larger scales.
Certainly. So, there's an interesting kind of juxtaposition on one side as you describe the kind of romance, but also the real danger. Thinking of the Colorados and even the Sierras, the narrow gauges that operated in those environments were, as you say, constructed with a slightly more artistic bent in terms of the environment, and particularly the kind of picturesque beauty, but also the small-scale nature of the operations had an implicit danger associated with maintenance, the inaccessibility of the areas, the fact that heavy snowfalls, these kind of things. I think the potential for not just areas, but also seasonal opportunities, a wide variety of different modelling perspectives, potentially maintenance crews, little bungalow shacks in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it has almost the kind of Wild West of the forests element to it, certainly in the US. In terms of the narrow gauge in Canada, is this a similar theme in Canada, or were they used to get to inaccessible areas, permanently snowed areas? I mean, what were the narrow gauges used for in Canada?
Back in the early days, colonization from England, they used 42-inch gauge railways in both Newfoundland and Prince Edward Island, as well as down in the city of Toronto, or York, I think it was at the time. They had 42-inch gauge railways, which was British colonial. You'll see that west coast of Australia and South Africa and a few other places where British influence was felt. And really, the primary reason for going narrow gauge was to reduce the amount of material that you had to move from one area to another, reduce the strenuous requirements of curvature and grade and the size of the rolling stock, so you had lower clearances and whatnot. In Canada, we had stuff on the East Coast, stuff in central areas, stuff on the West Coast. West Coast was primarily 3-foot, which was what you used to see in the States a lot. The Caslow and Slocan in British Columbia and the White Pass in Yukon going up through into the Alaska area, you know, virtually there was no other way to get in there. If you weren't going by rail from the docks in the seaport, you weren't getting in there at all. And some of those areas were opened up in the West Coast, primarily because of mining opportunities, precious metals, gold and silver. Also in the early days, we had broad gauge in the central area, especially. The Grand Trunk was built to 5'6". Not 4'8.5". In fact, you couldn't get a grant from the government or permission from the government unless you built to that gauge.
Gosh.
And that ran at one point in time, the Grand Trunk ran all the way down into Portland, Maine, which was one of the reasons I wanted to go down there to the museum myself to see some of the other end of the line, so to speak.
So were they heavier trains as well?
Not as such, really. I think the 5'6" gauge, one of the reasons for 5'6" gauge was to prevent the easy transit of troops north of the border in case of war. No, seriously, that
I
was one of
imagine.
The reasons.
Yes.
Not that that made a difference, because in the U.S. Civil War, where there were gauge differences between the north and the south, the track crews could change the gauge on entire sections of track in hours using just the rails and spikes, moving them in. It was done many times. And in some cases, in Australia, in fact, where they had 3 gauges, they had broad, narrow, and standard gauge, and everything had to be transshipped. If you wanted to go from one side to the other, you had to change trains twice.
Certainly.
With all the goods. And there were experiments with bogies that could change gauge so that you could actually screw the wheels in and out to the different gauges instead of unloading everything
Yes.
on the way. And they were not very successful, I think, in the long run. Narrow gauge in Canada, a lot of construction projects, dams, highways, and large excavations were serviced by either tramways or railways from 15 inches on up to 42 inches at various points in time. So, again, that railways move material, and whether it's ballast or cement or asphalt or any other material for construction projects. That's ubiquitous on all the big projects everywhere in North America, as well as the continent and in England. So, what did we use narrow gauge? We used it for everything up here, but at one time, one of the initial benefits for going narrow gauge was simply that it was cheaper per mile to build a railway to narrow gauge standards than it was to build the standard gauge standards, if you'll pardon the double standard there.
Certainly.
Less material, less time, lighter weight equipment, lighter weight rail, tighter clearances. But again, that if you were going to do something serious for the long term, as in Newfoundland, where a 30-ton boxcar was the norm, as opposed to a 40 or 50-ton boxcar from the mainland, you had a weight limit. Now, if you wanted to transship, for every boxcar you unload, every mainland boxcar you unloaded, you need 1 1/4 narrow gauge boxcars to carry the same amount of material, plus the time it took to do the transshipment. So for lines that were completely isolated, that were end-to-end, and there was no transshipment of goods, narrow gauge was okay. But if you had to transit between locations by over a gauge change, your economies were quickly shot right out of the water.
And in terms of the, I mean, what you're describing with regards to getting to inaccessible areas and these kind of things, that sounds like it mirrors the American experience in terms of potential danger and these kind of things as well, that the areas that they were probably putting these narrow gauge railroads into were also probably potentially dangerous in terms of rock slides and other things associated with remote mountain locations. I'm assuming that's similar too.
Yeah. There were a number of stories of horrific accidents in the construction of a lot of the lines and through the Rocky Mountains, whether you were talking north or south of the border. And again, you're trying to move men and materials from one place to the other. The less of Mother Nature you had to shift in order to do that, the better off you were in terms of time and money to get it built. But it does, the whole narrow gauge theme smacks of the real pioneering Wild West, seat of the pants kind of approach to things.
Certainly. Yeah.
Even East Coast railroading in through Maine with their 2-foot lines, the equipment it's difficult. It almost seems like amusement park equipment in some ways, because the scale of it is off when you see it parked next to standard gauge equipment of the same era. And again, keeping in mind that you're going into a remote area either for hunting or fishing or going to cabins or resorts, you're not carrying, you're never intended to carry mainline quantities of freight or passengers. It's all sort of niche market. Again, it's the fringe. It's the how inexpensively can we go to serve these customers and still maintain a level of reliability?
So for folks who are listening in that are interested in getting into narrow gauge, I mean, would you say ON30 was the place to start in terms of simplicity, in terms of accessibility of rail and locos and cars and things like that?
You'd be hard-pressed to find anything. In some places, you can find more ON30 than you can N-scale right now. And Bachmann has produced such a quantity of it that the prices, compared to when I was involved in it, when I was dabbling in it a few years ago, the prices are actually cheaper today than they were then. in some cases by half for boxcars and flat cars and the basics of setting up a train. If you want to experiment with narrow gauge, though, I would recommend the problem with ON30 is that it's neither fish nor fowl. It's not truly representative of the 3-foot gauge equipment, and it's not truly representative of the 2-foot gauge equipment. They have engines that are remarkably close to some of the equipment used on the Denver and Rio Grande, and they have engines that are remarkably close to those used on the Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes. But they're not either one. And if you're looking for, again, depending on the level of fidelity you're trying to achieve, if you can overlook the variation in gauge, then yes, ON30 is an excellent place to start. Quarter-inch scale, you can find an awful lot of detail parts, an awful lot of figures, vehicles, and drawings in the popular press to allow you to start scratch building. There's many kits available in quarter-inch scale for structures and rolling stock, and even those Christmas Village items that you find at the height of the season, at discounters. I think a lot of those are in quarter-inch scale. In fact, I think one of the first ON30 trains that came out from Bachmann was a Christmas passenger train designed to be used with those quarter-inch scale Holiday Village components. Oh. So you can repurpose those very easily. There is a number of die-cast vehicle manufacturers that do 1 to 48 equipment. And certainly you can run on HO scale track, keeping in mind that the ties are going to be too close together relative to the scale that you're going for. You can clip out every second tie with a pair of pliers, and that will help. Again, they'll be a little short compared to what they should be for the length. If you ballast heavily enough, that's not going to be an issue one way or another. And it's certainly a quick and easy way to get into narrow gauge. And you can, the ready-to-run equipment is cheap enough that you don't feel like you're doing something expensive. If you want to modify it, if you want to lower the stance of it to give it a more accurate appearance, if you want to cut it up and use the ready-to-run equipment to make a more accurate model of any particular prototype that you're going after, whether it's the Gilpin tram or the Denver and Rio Grande or the Sandy River. There's a lot of eastern narrow gauge railways that are really not well known. East Broadtop is, of course, but there's stuff like the Tionesta Valley and good gosh, my mind's gone blank. There's probably several dozen in the northeast corner of the U.S. alone that would make good topics for these trains. And experimentation, you're not cutting into a brass locomotive, you're not cutting into something that's incredibly rare and impossible to replace. So picking up a Bachmann boxcar for $15 or $20, you know, you're not going to feel any pang of regret when you take the hacksaw to it and make it a little longer, a little narrower, a little taller, lower it, or put double doors in or something. So have fun. Yes, enjoy. Try it out. See if you like it. In the Narrow Gauge Gazette, the Narrow Gauge and Short Line Gazette, there were a number of articles by Mallory Hope Farrell on real 30-inch gauge railways. I think he did 8 or 10 articles in a row, which were excellent and gave you information on real 30-inch gauge railways that operated that you could model if you wanted to be super accurate about it. And if you chose to model 3-foot equipment, there's plenty of ON3 and SN3 out there. Not for the faint of heart when you see the price tag on them, though. Engine prices can range anywhere from $700 to $2,700, depending on how rare it is. And again, in the popular press, there are quite a number of drawings and plan sets for line side structures and rolling stock that you can build at your leisure. One of the ones that really appealed to me that would be in the list of if I could do it all over again would be the ones that they were on the islands of Hawaii during the war. They have some tremendous 3-foot gauge railways that are well documented in some new books that just came out that Trevor showed me a few weeks ago.
It would be
really
an interesting
thing.
Yes.
And if you want to model the 2-foot stuff, there's a number of models of engines have recently been imported by Train and Trooper in S-scale, 2-foot gauge, and there are some number of 2-foot gauge engines and cars in O-scale, although they're a little bit harder to find, as I don't think there's any recent production runs in ON2. Working in HON2, I'm sorry, you'd have to be a masochist to do that. It's just, it's narrower than N scale in terms of the railhead to railhead distance. And mechanisms are difficult to get working reliably. Steam mechanisms are difficult to get working reliably in that situation. And the larger scales, if you want to work in the garden scales, there's lots of 60 centimeter and 2-foot gauge equipment produced for the garden. And, I don't know, there's other things you could pursue, but the primary narrow gauges were 2-foot and 3-foot in North America, a lot of 42 inch and meter gauge in colonial, situations and, 60 centimeter, 75 centimeter, 90 centimeter stuff in Europe and in the UK. And some of it is just so appealing. You'll see it and say, oh, I have to do that. And that'll be the end of it for you. good candidate for a micro layout if you want to dabble without completely diluting whatever your primary interest is. Narrow gauge is an excellent subject for the micro layout because you can enjoy the tighter radius curves and the smaller equipment, but still have fairly large structures and people. Not for everyone, but certainly worth looking into if you might be feeling a little bit stale in what you're doing right now and need to reinvigorate yourself in the hobby.
Fascinating. Fascinating. And yeah, I'll echo what you're saying in terms of the structure building potential in this scale. And as you said earlier, the rickety backwoods element associated with the kind of structures that existed in these environments kind of multiplies the modeling potential in a wide variety of different directions. Chris, I know it disappoints you every time the show has to come to an end, but I was looking at Anthony Smith's post associated with Model Rail Radio, keeping him awake. Unfortunately, I know you're a fan of our ginger and white cat Bertie, who takes a liking to the occasional turnout. Both him and his little companion have fallen asleep on my lap through the period of recording the show. So we may keep Anthony Smith awake, but unfortunately we have not kept my my cat's awake, and I think as they wake, they will probably want feeding. So it's been wonderful to have the opportunity to chat with you today, Chris, and I think you've offered a lot of inspiration, certainly from the folks in the chat. We have Steve in Chicago in the chat briefly. We've had Matt Goodman and Andrew Chisholm in the chat for the entire time, and this mysterious guest six, who also appears to be me, has been in the chat too. So wonderful as always, Chris. I promise I'll have a proper update in 2 weeks' time. And you haven't had an update with regards to your basement layout. Do you anticipate you having enough time in the next 2 weeks to do anything associated with that?
I'd love to say yes, but I'm not sure. Given the current demands on my time from domestic and various family, extended family events that are coming up, I can't say for sure whether I'm going to have anything done in the basement, except for the strenuous efforts I'm making to build bookcases at a ever-increasing rate.
Very good.
To try and get things sorted and away.
Yes.
Which, of course, precipitated cleaning out all of the previous inmates' flotsam and jetsam that had still occupied all the nooks and crannies. So right now it's construct and destruct, but no actual fabrication of railway elements.
Very good. Very good. Well, the slumbering cats are starting to wake, so I probably should sign off at this point. Thanks out to Matt and Andrew in the chat that are saying it was a wonderful show. And for folks listening in who'd like to participate as well, you too can participate in the famous Model Rail Radio chat sessions that go on as the show's recorded live. You can ask questions, comment, give some general discussion, and also generally participate in the show. So if you'd like to do that, and typically we're recording now, I guess, 4:30 Pacific, 7:30 in the evening Eastern, which also fits in with good times in Australia and New Zealand, Saturday in the US, Sunday in Australia and New Zealand. But we can change the times if need be. Certainly, Chris and I have done it at various times, Friday night, these kind of things too. So if you want to get involved and the time isn't good for you, please email me directly, tom@modelrailradio.com. We have the Facebook group. We have the mailing list that you can get to from the Model Rail Radio website. Chris, it's been a pleasure as always. I look forward to talking to you in 2 weeks' time.
Take care, Tom.